Sometimes we miss the point of the most familiar, famous sayings in the English language. E.g., Benjamin Franklin on death and taxes. "Our new constitution is now established and has an appearance that promises permanency," he wrote. "But in this world, nothing can be said to be certain, except death and taxes." Franklin wasn't moaning about death and taxes. He was delivering a great warning that states fail. The United States may look permanent, but there is no guarantee that it would survive. And states don't, is the conclusion of my guest today, Luke Kemp, who's recently published a vast survey of the collapse of states called Goliath's Curse: The History and Future of Societal Collapse. Luke, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Why is this subject so profoundly fascinating? Why do we, as we study history, as we think about the past, always come back to the question of why this empire, this state, has failed?
I think there's three good reasons. One is that people have always been profoundly interested and fascinated by the end of worlds, whether it be the apocalypse, eschatology, as we call it, or just simply catastrophe and crisis. I think the second is that we are, in many ways, the victors of history, and collapse is something which essentially haunts even the most powerful of empires. And so it's natural that we tend to kind of look over our shoulders at the wreckages of the past and wonder if we're going to end up the same. And I think last but not least is that collapse in many ways is a term of propaganda. When you look at the different ways collapse has been written about, it's generally by a small number of scribes employed by kings and elites who talk about collapse as a way of warning: if there's no hierarchy, if there's no kings, things will fall apart and will be absolutely terrible and awful. And when you actually look at the archaeological record, that's not always the case. So I think we've also been handed down a set of stories which have emphasized collapse and probably overemphasized how bad it is. And as a very brief aside, the funny thing with the death and taxes idea is that taxes are probably only around about 5,000 years old.
And taxes matter, as we'll get to in the argument as we go through. You write, and it's a beautiful line, "Once you pull on the thread of collapse, the entire tapestry of history begins to unravel." What do you mean by that?
I want to do quite a restricted study, just looking at collapse, to better understand the risks we face in the future. And I found quite quickly that was essentially impossible without addressing far bigger questions, such as, why were states even created in the first place? Were they good for the citizens and the subjects who lived within them? And how do people actually act during crises and catastrophes? And what I found was that in almost all of those cases, my intuitions and the ideas have been handed down ever since high school were profoundly challenged. For instance, most of us tend to think of civilization as being essentially both an intentional and benevolent act, that people came together in large groups because they started to have grain, for instance. And as you had bigger groups of people, you needed to basically coordinate them to do bigger projects. And so hence we had kings, etc. And that just simply isn't really the case. When you look at what really unites all civilizations throughout history, it tends to be things like slavery, patriarchy, domination, basically. And the only real set of common factors across why civilizations arise across the world is actually things like having resources which are easily taken, stored, and transported. And so that's why, for instance, you have many states which are built on rice and wheat, which can be stored for up to decades or more. But you don't have any which are built on, say, for instance, taro or bananas. And the other kind of common fact which comes up here is having caged land. So, for instance, Egypt is, of course, buttressed between the Red Sea and the Nile. And on top of that, having weapons that can be easily monopolized by a small group. So you don't see the rise of the first states in either Mesopotamia, so the Near East, or in Egypt, until you start to get bronze handheld swords and axes. So the picture emerging there is that states, when they were first created, were probably acts of subordination, essentially, and domination, that you had a small group essentially taking resources that others were dependent upon, and then more or less using that to create these kind of larger power structures. the power structures we often call civilization. I much prefer Goliath, which you know really captures what we're actually talking about here, which is these big institutions built on power and violence. But yes, I think that's just one small example of if you want to really understand collapse, you want to understand why we create these big power structures in the first place. And suddenly you have to address all the big questions in human history.
There was a trade-off though, wasn't there? Hierarchical states brought order, even tough states, an end to chaos.
Yes and no. One of the things I wanted to do with this book was not just to look at the collapse of empires in the last few thousand years, but rather to go back as far as possible to the very beginning of our species. One of the key questions that always pops up there is when you look 300,000 years ago, when our species first started to evolve in Africa, were we particularly violent? What were the kind of social conditions we evolved in? The best evidence we have right now suggests that we were nomadic egalitarian hunter-gatherers and that we weren't particularly violent. When you look at the archaeological remains, and the largest study here has been done by two archaeologists, Haas and Bishteli, you actually find very, very few skeletal remains which have any signs of violence. Genetic evidence suggests that at the very maximum, we probably had a roughly 2% per year violence rate, which basically means out of 100 deaths per year, two of them would be based upon violent causes, which is around about the same as the global average today if you count suicide. So we're not a particularly violent species. And when you actually look at collapse and the kind of violence that often happens, and of course, collapse does often see these big spikes in bloodshed, it's usually not the entire society killing each other. It's not brother on brother, sister on sister. It's instead usually a very small group of people, generally speaking, young men who are trying to create a new power structure. You know, think of Afghanistan, think of Somalia. It's only a very small group, once again, young men who are usually trying to basically recreate a state or some kind of other power structure. So even in those cases, it's a lot more complicated than this kind of Hobbesian image of a war of all against all. It's nothing like that, actually. It's actually much more state formation. So in many ways, the kind of violence of state collapse is the violence of trying to build a new state.
You make a distinction between collapse and societal collapse. Explain.
So when a state like in Somalia in 1989 falls apart, we call it a state collapse or a state failure. When the economy suddenly breaks apart and economic growth contracts massively, we call it a recession or a depression, or sometimes an economic collapse. When the population dies off very quickly due to a disease or a natural disaster, we call it a demographic collapse or a bust. But when you have multiple systems and of power all go down, so not just the state, but also the economy and potentially population. When all these happen at once, you can think of it as a societal collapse.
And what for you is the key example of a societal collapse where everything goes bust?
Oh, that's a very good question. First of all, it's actually surprisingly rare for all these systems to go down at once and for all of them to go down rapidly. I think we tend to overuse the term collapse when thinking about history. I would say the best example here is actually one of the least well-known, which is Cahokia. So Cahokia was the original city of North America. Around about 1,000 years ago, hunter-gatherers in the Mississippi Basin, about 500 kilometers south of Chicago, on the outskirts of modern-day St. Louis, started to create a city. They basically piled up huge mounds of dirt and soil into these vast earthen pyramids with flat tops. It actually looked very similar to what you see in modern Mayan city-states, for instance, or across Mesoamerica. They started sacrificing people. They started to have elites and kings. And then essentially, within around about 150 years, it starts to fall apart. People more or less seem to vote with their feet and start to leave en masse. This is coincides with droughts and several other things, but Cahokia is interesting for a few reasons. Is first of all, it's complete abandonment. The entire city's lost. There's no more hierarchy. Even much of the culture changes as well. So all the kind of key power structures you would associate with modern with a state fall apart. But importantly, it's also really enduring. You know, if this only happens for a year or two, if this is a kind of temporary loss, we wouldn't really consider it a collapse. But when it's enduring, we do. And in the case of Cahokia, once the city falls apart, it's never rebuilt. When the Europeans arrive, there are no large-scale cities anymore in Northern America. And even more interesting is that the people there seem to intentionally forget about this experiment with urbanism and priests. There's no oral traditions, no stories in the Mississippi Basin about Cahokia, which is incredibly interesting and surprising, given that this is literally a city of 10,000, 15,000 people. And yet it's almost like they wanted to forget about it and leave it to rot in the swamps of the Mississippi.
I'm talking to Luke Kemp, research affiliate at the Centre for Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge. Luke has also been at times an advisor to the World Health Organization, the Australian Parliament, the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, but we're talking today about his new book, Goliath's Curse, The History and Future of Societal Collapse. Luke, in our culture, the great collapse was the fall of Rome. And I have to ask, did Gibbon get it right?
To put it short, I mean, for those of you at home, Gibbon's key idea...
Did I hear you say no?
Yes, that's a very strong no. I think Gibbon's right that I would consider the collapse, the Western Roman Empire, to have collapsed. But even there, it's worthwhile pointing out that some things changed much more rapidly than others. You know, the actual political center of Rome collapses very, very quickly. But the population, well, it doesn't really depopulate for another somewhere between 60 to 100 years. And the kind of ideological basis of Rome, which by that stage was the church, actually continued to grow in power. You know, the church becomes the connective tissue across all of Europe after Rome falls. So it's not like every power structure in society falls apart. Some of them do continue. And likewise, many of the cultures, customs, and even garbs that the Romans had were carried on by Germanic rulers. But nonetheless, the military fragments, the economy plummets, trade breaks up into local levels, and essentially both the elites and the kind of the actual empire itself falls apart. So we're still on good grounds to call it a collapse. The other key thing of Rome is that Gibbons does two things. First of all, he blames it on Christianity, and that's just not true. The key culprit behind the collapse of Rome is inequality.
Yes.
It's much more about inequality and the wealthy than it is about the church and Christianity. And the second one is that Gibbons sees this as being just a fairly horrible event, almost a kind of ancient apocalypse of sorts. And it really wasn't. Rome was, in many ways, an autocratic machine for turning grain into swords and conquest. It was a very large-scale pyramid scheme. And its collapse was, in many ways, a good thing for a lot of people. So when we look at skeletons in Latin Europe after the fall of Rome, people seem to get taller and healthier. So skeletons get larger, and there's less both dental caries and bone lesions. And in general, actually, if you were living outside the empire, you tended to be in a healthier state than if you were living inside the empire.
It's worth remembering that. That's wonderful. That's such a wonderful finding.
Weirdly enough.
But you mentioned inequality. And through your book, I just kept finding this as a theme, that states that become unequal fall. And look around the world today, and inequality is on the march, even in our societies. You know, Australia that you grew up in, Britain where you now work, the United States. Do you see in that growth of inequality the death of states?
Yes. Inequality is the master variable behind crisis and collapse. When we think about a risk, we usually try to break it down to four key components. So one is the threat. This could be, in the case of Rome, invaders. It could be climatic change, which occurred roughly in the 6th century. And it can also be disease. Obviously, I have things like the Justinian Plague in the 6th century as well. But then you also have what's often not paid attention to, the second element of risk, which is vulnerability. And the key thing here is that inequality tends to make states and societies much more vulnerable over time. And in stories of collapse, we tend to get a bit too preoccupied with looking at threats, with things like climate change, with the invaders, these kind of big external shocks. But for many different cases of collapse, you find that different societies handle these pretty well, actually. And then suddenly they seem to become weaker over time. And myself and several colleagues actually did a kind of large-scale data analysis looking at a big database we put together of essentially the lifespan of almost every state across history. And we found that they do appear to become weaker over time. And the most natural explanation here, and the one with the most evidence, is that this is largely due to the fact that inequality seems to increase over time and hence make states more fragile. And I can get into the reasons as to why, if you like.
Well, I wonder whether you'd, what you think about this. After the Second World War, there was a strong emphasis on equality in Britain, Australia, the United States. In Britain, punitive taxes on the very rich, plus wonderful new services to the poor, and a sense that, you know, we've all been through this turmoil together of the Second World War, and the reward would be equality. And perhaps one way of looking at the history of the 80 years since is the political eating away at the equality that was established in that fight.
We often speak about World War One and World War Two as being a time of the Great Compression. Several things happened during the World War. One was that you had enormous destructions in capital, and that essentially meant that the rich just lost much more than the poor did. The second is that, as you mentioned, there was the introduction of a whole bunch of different policies which tended to level the playing field. And these were often necessary to essentially keep the populace happy in a time of war, and more importantly, keep them willing to actually fight on behalf of their country.
You know? Yes.
Today, I suspect that many people would be less willing to fight for the UK or Australia because it's hard to want to fight for something when you can't even afford a house and when you're not even sure if you're going to be taken care of when you're sick, for instance. And last but not least, was just people were armed. And when you have a very large populace which is armed and trained, then suddenly there's a much better reason for the elites to negotiate with them. And as you mentioned, this did result in some pretty huge changes. The highest income bracket in the US during the kind of 1950s was actually above 90%. And it's worth noting that that didn't...
Taxation.
Exactly, yeah. And yeah. It's worth... Yeah. That didn't result in a kind of economic collapse. You know, it's to the contrary, when people talk about making America great again, they're usually thinking about this kind of time, although it obviously wasn't particularly great to be either black or a woman. Nonetheless, I think you're precisely right. Essentially, while there was a great compression of wealth inequality during the 1950s after world wars, you start to see creeping up during the 1980s and 1970s. And shortly after that, we start to see, of course, democratic backsliding and all the issues we're kind of contending with today start to come to the fore. And I think the retreat of democracies around the world is directly related to that increase in wealth inequality. It's not hard to look at the US and think, well, billionaires are basically just more or less buying elections at this stage, and that's a direct outcome of wealth inequality.
It's what made me think of Benjamin Franklin. Mm. Luke, you have this wonderful thing in the book where you've done all your research, you've totted up all the numbers, and you have decided all states throughout history have eventually ended average lifespan 326 years. Now, it's outrageous, by the way, but wonderful. What makes a state last longer? What makes a state last shorter? I mean, you know, there are... The Byzantium lasted 1,000 years, but some of the dynasties in China were gone in 4. Can you look... I mean, inequality is there underneath all of this, but... Do big states last longer than small states, for instance?
First of all, I'm glad you mentioned both the average 326, but also more importantly, the range here. People tend to get distracted by the average, but as you mentioned, the Byzantine Empire lasts over 1,000, while the Qin Dynasty lasts for just 14. So there's a huge range here. What makes a society more resilient? What makes it last longer? Part of this is always going to, of course, be luck, but I think that's not the key element. Instead, when you look across numerous case studies, it seems that one of the most important factors here is essentially how democratic and inclusive the institutions are. Peter Peregrin at Yale University has done some of the best studies here looking at how different societies respond with climatic change throughout the past. So he's looked at different instances like the late antique Little Ice Age and tried to tally up what's the amount of cooling different societies faced, and the amount of social change they faced as well. So were there assassinations? Was there large-scale loss of population, etc.? And the interesting thing he found was that, first of all, while there was a rough correlation, there were many cases where you had lots of cooling but very little social change. And second, the biggest factor that made a society resilient to climatic change was how inclusive and democratic their institutions were. And this is echoed in modern-day studies as disaster risk resilience, where big meta-reviews have essentially found that having a stronger state with more resources, which is not surprising, but more importantly, having more democratic, inclusive institutions tends to result in states lasting longer, which makes a lot of sense. And it's kind of, in many ways, the flip side of wealth inequality. Democracy and wealth inequality, of course, are quite the same thing, but they do overlap. You know, if you have lots of wealth inequality, it's going to be very hard to keep a democracy in the long term. And when you, for instance, you look at Athenian democracy, that was built on the back of having a pretty high degree of wealth equality. So democracy and inclusive institutions seems to be the big thing that encourages states and societies to often last longer.
Because citizens have an investment in the state in which they live.
That's part of it.
I don't mean cash. I mean, there are reasons to be loyal.
Precisely. It seems to create a greater sense of solidarity and collective identity, what many researchers call social capital, essentially. People feel invested in the community and the state. On top of that, it seems like when you have larger, more diverse groups of people making decisions, you tend to get better decisions. So much of my background is in what's called forecasting foresight. And the best proven methods and used by the intelligence agencies, for instance, are what they use are called super forecasters. So basically groups of people who share information and try to take on a big, diverse set of different sources to make predictions about the future. And similarly, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's also just a very, very large group of different people deliberating and sharing information. By comparison, an autocracy is usually a small group of homogenous people who are overinvested in the status quo, trying to make decisions, which is just an ingredient for disaster. And when we look at, say, for instance, climate change today, or even trying to change things like taxation, for instance, it's usually the existing elite class who essentially stop any kind of change from occurring. What is usually benevolent, necessary change. So that's also a key thing, is just simply that when you have huge concentrations of decision-making power, it tends to be with people who don't want to change society and are buffered from oncoming disaster.
You seem to be arguing that the people can take the tough decisions to fix societies and indeed to fight inequality. I don't see much sign of that in Australia, Britain or America at the moment, that the people are capable, for instance, of taxing the rich.
I think absolutely they are. I mean, all societies are, of course, based upon the people. You know, we tend to give far too much credence to people like Elon Musk, for instance, when there's not really that much sign that he's actually a particularly great inventor or even that good a manager. By comparison, most of the enterprises he's created, whether it's SpaceX or Twitter or Tesla, they're built upon the backs of thousands of miners in Africa, programmers in San Francisco, and manufacturers in China. You know, the world is built on the backs of the people. And all the evidence we have suggests that if you want to do good decision-making, you don't rely upon a small number of rich people and just hope to make good decisions. One of the things that really gives me a lot of hope in the future is what we call deliberative democracy. Essentially, you select people at random for a sortition or a lottery, which is what was done in ancient Athens, and you inform them with experts and let them make decisions. And over again, across different studies, and even in real-world examples, like in Ireland during the abortion debate, we find that this tends to work pretty well. It results in less polarization. It tends to result in much better deliberation because people are more likely to change their mind than politicians are. And it tends to result in just better decisions as well. Most of the time right now.
Yeah, there is indeed a movement for that in Australia. It's a resolute movement, but it worries me, Luke. I don't see what the authority of those decisions is. I can't see that randomly selected people have the authority to impose on other people their decisions. But that's perhaps a discussion for another time. Look around the world for me as a last contribution to this conversation, Luke. Look around the world and tell me the society which the state you think is closest to societal collapse.
I'll push back a little bit on that, because it's very easy for me to say one of the countries within the Horn of Africa, maybe, for instance, maybe Yemen, for instance, which is already more in a state of civil war. But when we talk about societal collapse, we're usually talking about the collapse of an entire life. And the thing is that today we live in one global interconnected system. And when we do have collapse, such as the collapse of Somalia or Afghanistan, it tends to be very short-lived. Essentially, resources are mobilized to make sure that a new state is propped up very quickly. And when we talk about societal collapse, people are usually worried about a global collapse. And that is what we need to worry about. And if we're really thinking about a global collapse, then the things we have to start worrying about today are much more things like nuclear war, climatic change, and dangerous new technologies. And even all of those are once again built upon large systems of inequality and extraction. So I wouldn't worry about any given state. I'd worry about the world as a whole.
That is a way to cheer us up, Luke. We don't need to worry about the United States of America. Benjamin Franklin's worst fears may not be about to come true. The whole world could collapse. Luke, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live. Luke Kemp is, amongst many other things, the author of this book, Goliath's Curse: The History and Future of Societal Collapse. It's a completely fascinating survey of catastrophe in the history of the world. It is to be published by Penguin Random House. Luke, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.